Hello, hello, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and thank you for joining us on another fine Monday day, I suppose, because I'm not sure when you're listening to this. Probably afternoon, probably evening. I'm, of course, joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
Well, you just informed me that now the previous episode I became a drinking game. So this time, I'm just coming prepared to hear a lot of Churchill.
So, one of our comments has suggested a drinking game for the show where every time Herman quotes Churchill, you have to take a drink. I think that this is very dangerous and could lead to severe liver damage, but we'll see.
Which will make you more like Churchill?
No, exactly. We are, of course, also joined by Ms. Aragon. Sorry, how are you?
Well, it's the cold front is coming, clearly.
The cold is coming, and so we must settle in for a grim week of terrible freezing cold. And while we huddle around our phones and our podcasts to struggle through it,
Thank you.
of course, last night we had a discussion by the president in these very annoyingly called family meetings, which is a term I absolutely loathe, and it seems to have become almost official at this point.
Is anyone who's
But
using
it seems, though, that the age of lockdowns or harsh lockdowns has passed, because despite the fact that the COVID numbers suggest that there is a looming third wave, or we are in the third wave already, that we didn't really see too much tightening of restrictions. So that's pretty good. And actually, on that point, let's get into our first story for today, which is a
I just
report
want to
from.
say, Nick.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to say that, the good thing about a cold front is we will always have hot takes. So if anyone's ever, just iced out by the process, just come to the Daily French Show, put us on. It's like a faux fireplace somewhere, and just hold up your hands and feel the warmth of the hot takes.
So I saw there was someone in a review who said that we were pure propaganda. So I think if you are enraged by the things we say on this show, hopefully that rage will keep you warm through this very cold week.
And
Anyway,
Nick, one very, very short thing. We were pure propaganda because apparently we judged the Israel-Palestine thing only one way. I remember clearly being on the show saying, I don't think I've got all the facts to clearly put myself in one camp or the other. So, I mean, I'm probably a pretty shit propagandist. I mean, it's just a good thing I don't work for the state. I would be, the fence, be on it.
No, well said, sir. But speaking of something else that can keep you warm, and if I can segue now without Herman interrupting me, there's a report from the alcohol industry, which has, I think, probably unsurprisingly, but I also don't think uncredibly, produced a report showing that illegal alcohol sales, possibly in part driven by the effects of the lockdown laws, have gone way up. So the South African Liquor Brand Owners Association, the Beer Association of South Africa, and Vinpro, in a joint statement, say that there has, quote, been a dangerous increase in the illicit sale of alcohol due to the prohibitions. They cited a report that they had commissioned by the Euromonitor International, which is called Illicit Trade, Alcoholic Drinks in South Africa in 2020. They found that illicit alcohol trade had grown. They found that it had grown at a compound annual growth rate of 17% since 2017, and they estimated that the illegal liquor industry is now about 12% of the 1.77 billion rand alcohol industry in South Africa overall. They went on to say basically that the banning of alcohol during lockdown enlarged the illegal alcohol industry by a significant amount, because people had to turn to illegal sales in order to get hold of liquor, and that this now that they think that in 2020 they now estimate illegal liquor to be something like 22% of total alcohol consumption. They also believe that SARS lost about 11.3 billion rand due to illicit alcohol trade. So let me start with you, Herman. The first thing I guess we have to ask is, this is a report from the alcohol industry. So how should we take that into consideration? But secondly, I think that this, we said on the show, this would be the fairly predictable result of banning alcohol, is that when you have prohibition, you have the growth in illegal trade. What's your take on the subject?
Well, I think as ever, you know, vested interest is something to consider. And I think we definitely should consider that and read this report critically. I haven't yet. But I must say the one of the cheapest ways of shutting down a conversation or a debate these days is going with a good old who funds you line. There seems to be this acknowledgement on the right and the left, by the way, that right. If you
that's
can...
thrown at us a lot, actually.
Yes. Exactly. And so there's this idea, whether you're George Soros or the Koch brothers, well, I think it's only the Koch brother now, you have this situation where if you can point to the source of funding, you immediately discredit whatever research might flow from that funding. And I think that's a very, very dangerous thing to do. I mean, it's just stupid. It's just nonsense. It's the genetic fallacy.
Right, it's not terribly surprising that people producing results that someone agrees with will get funded by that person. It doesn't have to be the other way around, that the funding produces the results, right?
Yeah. So that said, when you know something is funded, especially by a vested commercial interest, you know, do your homework. Look whether the methodology checks out and whether the rest sort of bears resemblance to reality. And if we look at the headline findings from this report and we look at our own experience over the last year, I think there's more to believe here than to disbelieve, or there's more reason to err towards the side of this seems legit than not. And in that case, the question really becomes, you know, what did the government think it was going to achieve? And I think we see a lot of things here with also with the gun control thing. There's this idea that you can control a population through legislation, that law once passed will immediately and with great authority and impact regulate human behavior. And that's just not the case. I think you can imagine it if you're Behi Tele or Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. You just think people accept holy writ given down from, you know, the state. But the problem is, if you're going to be in power and you're going to make laws and you're going to make rules, then you have to be aware of the fact that there's a zone of tolerance and a zone of acceptance, things that you can legislate within. And it's a difficult thing to read. It's not a science, and it's you know, people who criticize the social contract will hate me for saying this, but there's a sort of tacit acceptance that some things handed down from government can be considered reasonable and rational enough so as to impact human behavior. But the problem is if you're going to go to human vices and you try to control alcohol sales, we have so many historical instances of where that just doesn't work. So heading into this, we all said to government, this is a nonsense, don't try to regulate it. And surprise, surprise, this is what the result is. So on the first point, yeah, I do think we have reason to believe this is rational. On the second point, one doesn't want to go, you know, the Jacques Pau route of insinuating that you know, the illegal cigarette trade funded some political interest. But the real sad thing is you really can't exclude it, can you?
Right. So, Sara, you know, I think there was a case probably to be made for very short-term usage of, you know, alcohol bans to reduce the impact on hospitals, that kind of thing. But the government clearly quite liked the results from the alcohol ban. I think, I can't remember who said it, might have been Behi Tele, talked about how crime had gone down in part because of this and how the hospitals were now cleared of stabbing victims due to alcohol-related violence. And in fact, this was a great thing, and maybe we should consider doing this for a much longer period of time. Of course, we also saw the alcohol bans lasted for much longer, I think, than was prudent. Do you think there's any chance that some in government may push for alcohol bans to become more common or maybe even permanent?
I think all that would happen is it would take alcohol sales, legal alcohol sales would simply shift to the illegal market. South Africans are not going to do it. The fact that we do have problems that are triggered by alcohol, such as crime and road deaths, we are not going to solve it by banning alcohol. All we're going to do, in fact, is move it into the illicit market and reduce the amount owed to the fiscus by the legal companies. And I mean, they're complaining that the market has started moving to the illicit trade some time ago, particularly from 2012, when legal stringent regulations were placed on the legal alcohol industry. You have high sin taxes, what they call sin taxes, which is high excise taxes. So all of that created a good environment for
which seemed to go up every single year, basically, because
every single year, when the Minister of Finance presents his budget, they go up. The problem is you're caught between the fact that there are huge social problems relating to alcohol. On the other hand, it is is a huge employer, although that has reduced. And being a huge employer means it has a benefit for families in the wider circle. So, you know, these sort of heavy-handed bannings have a short-term effect, but they cannot resolve the longer-term problems. And, you know, go to Puhiman's point is you have to wonder to what extent there are people benefiting from the increase in the illicit trade, cigarettes and alcohol. But I think the beer market says that the 22% of beer consumption is illicit, and illicit sales exceed the wine and cider industries. So at the end of the day, probably the party that's going to suffer the most from all this finucane is going to be the government.
Indeed.
But Nick, if I might add one very brief thing, I think alcohol abuse is a real problem. I think in many instances there is a role for government to play there. But government needs to be very, very tactical as to what it does. Because if you look at all the available evidence that we can find, substance abuse that leads to the breakdown of family life and societies and all the checks and balances built into that sort of moral fiber of a community, that happens, that disproportionately affects the poorest. So whenever you are taking steps against an industry, the abuse of which product has problematic effects, you must never forget that it is oftentimes, especially in cases like the Western Cape, the very communities who are socioeconomically dependent on that sector. If you really want to solve or make advancement in terms of alcohol abuse and things like that, the easiest way, the data shows, is to uplift people socioeconomically. And if you're going to damage a sector like the wine sector, you must be very, very aware of the consequences that in the short term, as you say, you know, the hospital beds might be empty, but in the longer term, you are creating a larger societal problem that risks exacerbating the current issues so much more.
Definitely. Anyway, let us move on to our next story for today. And this is from a little report that was done by the Times Live News site, where they went to visit the South Africa-Lesotho border near Fariesburg. And this is following the arrest of a farm owner in the area earlier this month, a woman named Modihei Mofokeng. She was accused of setting up a quote-unquote toll gate at her farm, which enabled vehicle thieves and illegal immigrants to cross the border from Lesotho into South Africa for a fee. So Times Live visited the area and they talked to people and they found that basically that police and army patrols were not sufficient to keep the border secure, that all border fencing in some places is completely gone. So people can just sort of walk across the Caledon River, which is in some places very small, very narrow. In other places, there's major stock theft. I do know from some other anecdotal stories I've heard from that area that you're at great risk if you farm stock anywhere close to the border with Lesotho, because there's very often quite large-scale raids that come across from the border and people steal animals. And that a lot of these migrants coming over from Lesotho are not even driven necessarily by money, but simply for food. They've had apparently some bad farm years recently in Lesotho, and there's a lot of hardship on the population there now. So sometimes cows are stolen, for example, and slaughtered almost immediately for meat rather than actually trying to sell them again. Local farmers from the Farmers Union have taken over patrolling in some parts to try and protect the border from stock theft. But it's clear that the situation is pretty bad. Stock theft, illegal immigrants coming across, people looking for jobs, crime, illegal cars going across to be sold or to be stripped for parts, that kind of thing, stolen cars. So once again, like most stories in South Africa, it's a story of the police not really having a great grasp on the situation and people engaging in illegal activities, at least in part due to the economic deprivation. So, Sara, let me start with you. What's your take on this, and maybe what should government do to fix this problem?
What government should do and what government is capable of doing are two completely different things. I'm not surprised that the police and other governmental authorities aren't patrolling the border properly. This is basically an ongoing story, got worse, as you've spoken about the stock theft, etc. However bad things are in South Africa, in a country like Lesotho, which is poor, it's had, I think, 3 years of drought, as you say, and it's not producing food, people are going to come across the border. And it strikes me that the only way to mitigate this perhaps is if the government, instead of trying to do anything itself, actually, almost on behalf of Lesotho, appeals for international food aid and takes some of the pressure off South Africa, although I suspect we could use some food aid as well. Lesotho is in a precarious position because it's in the middle of South Africa. It's essentially self-contained. I don't know to what extent the sale of water and the pumping of water to South Africa is as big as it once was. So it's a recipe basically for disaster. I mean, essentially, particularly a wide but yet narrow border in the terms of the Caledon River is easy to cross. And the heartbreaking stories of, you know, women crossing with children, literally, to find anything that's better than what's in Lesotho. So I suspect the only thing we're going to see is a huge increase of illegal migrants desperately trying to compete with South Africans, understandably, for our resources. So I wonder whether the time hasn't come to look to organizational entities like the UN and try and take some pressure off ourselves to deal with these sorts of crises. But I mean, you know, you don't know what you're unlikely to get anything useful, because despite the fact that the Eastern Cape's reservoirs of water are down to 10-12%, the government still will not declare those areas disaster areas for that reason. Suggests not just incompetence, but a lack of political will, shall we say. So it's everything here is just going to get more desperate, and there's going to be more competition for resources.
One of the other interesting parts of the story that I forgot to mention was the fact that one of the reasons that there seems to have been an increase in illegal crossings recently is because to cross the border legally into South Africa from Lesotho, you require a COVID negative test. And those are beyond the financial resources of quite a lot of people in Lesotho, especially the very, very poor and very desperate, the ones who most want to get across. And so they are just crossing around over the river to avoid having to pay that.
And of course, that raises the question of, I have absolutely no idea what vaccine availability is in a place like Lesotho, because without vaccines, everything else is irrelevant.
They are poor and they are do have a small population, but I believe that they're currently, in terms of percentage vaccinated, actually ahead of us.
Everybody's ahead of us.
So,
It'd be less of a problem to not have your COVID paid for COVID test.
No, exactly. Herman, let's finish off here with a bit of a hot take, you know, to keep people warm this cold week. I think it was actually a COSATU union who a couple of years ago called for the annexation of Lesotho into South Africa, a thing that many people in Lesotho are very opposed to, although it's never really been polled, I think, particularly, so we don't actually know how many people are for or against it, but it's the kind of thing that arouses passion in many people. What's your view on that and just sort of this problem in general?
Well, it's an interesting historical curiosity as to why Lesotho was never incorporated into South Africa. And I looked into this matter about a year or two ago, and essentially the answer is the Brits thought they were too poor. There was so little there that there was just they couldn't see anything they could do with that.
There's another reason as well, which is the people of Lesotho resisted disarmament by the colonial authorities, who wanted to take away their firearms. And so as a result, they managed to get themselves taken out of the Cape Colony for other reasons as well. But interesting corollary to what's going on today.
Yeah, no, I was looking more at the, you know, at the early 20th century when the Union of South Africa started to be this concept, because there was also the possibility of then Rhodesia or the Rhodesian Territory, what is today Zimbabwe, becoming part of South Africa. So the four colonies of, you know, the Cape Natal, the Transvaal and the Orange Free State, it struck me as odd that Lesotho seems to be a natural ally there. So the first thing I think we must understand is Lesotho is a country with immense poverty. And that the sad thing here is that if South Africa could have its house in order, some of that economic upliftment would spill over into our neighboring countries. And if we have any interest in becoming sort of a pan-African, pro-African entity, then the best way really is to get our economy in going up and running again so that people can actually feel the benefits because of trade and money flowing. So that's the first point. The second point is, yes, I think we will probably see a continued influx of illegal immigration. And that's a bad thing for social cohesion. But it is not necessarily a bad thing for economic purposes, because if there's one thing one can say in defense of the vast, vast, vast majority of illegal immigrants in South Africa, they do not have a social security structure to look after them. So many of them have to sink or swim. Many of them actually become entrepreneurs in the informal economy and build themselves some sort of life on this side of the South African border. Now, of course, Herman Mashaba would be the first to cry some sort of xenophobic war cry here about, you know, crime is imported from overseas and these foreigners and these Nigerians come here to establish crime. And I just think that's dishonest and it's not connected to reality. I'm not for open border immigration. I think social cohesion is something important. I think if you are going to think the state, or if you're going to argue that the state has some responsibilities in looking after people on a social level, there must be some form of stability or cap on the numbers of people being looked after. However, the problem is it is such a lazy target that people will take aim at if socioeconomic circumstances deteriorate. These foreigners are here, they have jobs, we don't have jobs, so we must take them. When oftentimes, the sad thing is, foreigners come here, build little businesses of their own, get an income, because they don't have the disincentive not to work, not to do that. And they absolutely have the incentive to do that. So it's a complex issue, and I'm not really answering anything useful. But I just think that the nuance of you know, our relationships with our foreign neighbors is something that is too easily politicized without really taking into account that there are firstly human beings on the other side of that debate, and secondly, human beings who can actually play a very constructive role in our societies.
Right. And of course, once again, these problems wouldn't be so big if A, the police worked, and B, the economic conditions in South Africa were conducive to growth and prosperity, which would alleviate many of these problems in the first place. And if you want to find out how to fix those problems, read the IRR's reports, read the Daily Friend. But let's move on to our final story for today. And we're going to talk a little bit about the one character in South African big business who is probably consistently and most influentially and able to stand up to government and willing to stand up to government and call it out when it's doing silly things. And that is, of course, Neil Froneman, who is the CEO of Sibanye-Stillwater, which is the country's biggest gold mining company and one of the world's largest producers of platinum. So Neil Froneman has come out and attacked government for, he says, its restrictions on self-generation of electricity. And he says without lifting of these restrictions, or at least relaxing of these restrictions, the mining industry is going to run into serious problems in the coming years. Because he believes that in the future, people who buy minerals will be less willing to buy minerals from places that rely on very carbon-intensive forms of electricity. So in other words, from coal power or oil or that kind of thing. And that using renewables or alternatives will be much more, will help to keep South African mines in within the realm of minerals that can be purchased by foreign entities. Gwede Mwatashe has rejected appeals by business to raise the threshold for embedded generation. So that's generation by the mines themselves. It's currently at 10 megawatts. They want to raise it to 50 megawatts, but government has rejected this. Sibanye itself actually has a 50 megawatt project that it wants to start, but hasn't been able to get the regulatory approval to do so. It also wanted to produce 250 megawatts near Rustenburg, but it's also not been allowed to do that either. So Froneman basically said Mwatashe is making this very difficult. Businesses are going to have to discard their high carbon operations. Some of Sibanye, such as its ultra deep gold mines, will come to an end in 10 years time. And you'll have to grow your business being very cognizant of buying low emission projects. So it's yet another thing that could potentially disrupt South Africa's mining industry, which has suffered quite a lot in the past couple of years. The other thing Froneman slipped in there in his criticism of government was that the 80,000 employees of Sibanye, I believe they're the largest single employer in the country, they set up a program to be able to vaccinate all of them against COVID-19 at a rate of 18,000 per day, and government didn't allow them to. So now we're going to a third wave with them. Oh, they were also going to vaccinate the families of their workers. And that wasn't allowed by government either. So it looks like ideology is trumping common sense once again. Sarah, your thoughts very briefly.
Everything's trumping common sense with the government at the moment. I mean, that maybe we should try and get pressure on Sibanye to vaccinate the nation, because I'm sure they could do it more speedily and more effectively than the government can. What Neil Froneman was basically saying is that overseas investors are now, a condition of their investment is the move to renewable energy, sources of renewable energy. So it's not even a matter of whether Sibanye and other mining houses desperately want the renewables per se, it's that they are under obligation in order to attract and sustain the investment to move to renewables. One can, but I don't know what reason the government has for not doing it, but it's the thing that whatever their reasons are, nefarious or otherwise, it threatens to really hamper the industry, which hampers growth, which hampers the people who work for it, which hampers the communities around them. I mean, Neil Froneman has been sort of strong enough to come out against the fact that they are having to provide the services that the municipalities are failing to provide. So they get involved in a whole lot of social issues. They also get involved with strikes and protests that, you know, they can't, it's affecting their ability to produce. So all in all, it's a really problematic thing all around.
Yeah, Whoops, I think Sarah was being called there very briefly on Microsoft Teams. Herman, literally 30 seconds, your thoughts on this?
Well, I must say that there are some reasons to be fearful of independent power provision. It might destabilize a grid. It might generate those sorts of pressures. But I see absolutely no reason, none at all, when it's to the vaccines, whether it's to the independent power provision. I see no reason, but as you say, ideology, for solutions that are low-hanging fruits that can make life better immediately in South Africa. For those solutions not to be, ignored, but to be actively disallowed by a nefarious government, I think it's disgusting.
Definitely. So I guess to those who say that we don't offer solutions, I'll say, well, simply we could let people who do have the solutions in South Africa enact them rather than standing in the way. That's a good place to start. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. Please support the Institute of Race Relations, which, of course, supports and funds this show. We will see you tomorrow on The Daily Print Show. Have a good day, everyone.